From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tomorrow on the PBS series Frontline, Hodding Carter investigates the political career of former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Carter about Duke and about Carter's own confrontations with the Klan when he edited his family's newspaper in Mississippi. Also, we meet housewife-turned-megastar Dame Edna Everidge. She's the creation of Australian performer Barry Humphries. And from the Isn't Life Strange category, Soviet emigre David Gurevich tells us about his new relationship with the KGB. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. As expected, President Bush has vetoed a congressional attempt to impose trade conditions on China. The measure would require China to demonstrate substantial progress in the areas of human rights, trade, and weapons proliferation before the U.S. would renew its most favored nation trade status. The president has argued that such conditions would only weaken ties with China and strengthen repression in the country. He said the United States should work for change in China through dialogue and diplomacy. The Senate passed the measure last month by a vote of 59 to 39, far short of the two-thirds majority needed to override a veto. European community ministers meeting in Brussels are being asked for a major expansion in aid to the former Soviet republics. EC Foreign Trade Commissioner Franz Andriessen said that the world community should support the republics' reform efforts and help stabilize their currencies and external trade. The BBC's Simon Ingram reports from Brussels.
Mr. Andriessen presented the ministers with a gloomy assessment of the state of affairs in the CIS. The international community had to realize, he said, that it had a problem of global dimensions on its hands, in which issues of peace, security and stability were all linked. A new initiative was therefore needed, not only by the community, but by the United States, Japan and the industrialized world in general. This should go beyond the provision of emergency help and offer assistance with longer-term structural problems. It could take the form of currency stabilization programs, similar to that provided in the past to Poland and other former communist bloc countries. These would help the republics build up urgently needed economic ties among themselves.
The BBC's Simon Ingram in Brussels. In El Salvador, President Alfredo Cristiani today presided over the disbanding of two of the country's military-run police forces, the once-feared National Guard and the Treasury Police. From San Salvador, NPR's Tom Gibb reports.
There was a full military parade at the Treasury Police headquarters this morning. Through the war, the Treasury Police and National Guard earned the worst human rights reputations of all military units. A new civilian police force is being set up to replace them with some rebel participation. However, there are already delays in the peace process. The government has made a formal complaint to the United Nations because some rebel fighters have stayed away from agreed areas of concentration in protest at flights by attack aircraft over their positions. But while many observers expect more delays, there's no sign that the ceasefire is yet falling apart. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 8 points to close at 3,275. Advances edge declines in active trading of about 180 million shares. This is NPR. Sources close to the Congressional Intelligence Committee say that the Bush administration refuses to cut the intelligence budget in line with post-Cold War cuts in the defense budget. The secret budget is estimated at $30 billion for next year, about the same as it was before the demise of Soviet communism. Some members of Congress have argued that the budget should be cut along the lines of the military budget. The White House maintains that intelligence activities will be even more important after defense spending is cut. Vice President Dan Quayle today sought to enlist the support of one of the nation's largest veterans groups in efforts to get the president reelected and help block large-scale defense cuts on Capitol Hill. NPR's Carol Ann Clark reports.
Though challenger Pat Buchanan's name was never mentioned, the vice president was quick to acknowledge that George Bush is facing a challenge on two fronts in 1992.
One group believes we should pack up and say good luck to our friends and allies, come home, and maybe even throw up a fence around America for good measure. Another group wants to slash the Pentagon budget, declare a peace dividend, go on a social spending spree. Both these groups, my friends, seem to agree that defending America is somehow less of an issue than it used to be. They're wrong.
Quayle said the real peace dividend is peace itself. He appealed to the veterans to lobby against defense cuts, like those included in a $15 billion package of cuts making its way through the House. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
Consumer spending was up slightly in January, but it was the smallest increase in 3 months. The Commerce Department reported that consumer spending grew by a modest 0.2%, while Americans' personal income actually declined slightly by 0.1%. Consumer spending accounts for 2/3 of the U.S. economy. Spending on non-durable items such as food and fuel was up for the third month in a row. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back from vacation. Thanks to Marty Moss Cohen for filling in for me. Tomorrow there are presidential primaries or caucuses in 7 states. David Duke won't be on the ballot in any of them. The former Ku Klux Klan leader, who was constantly in the headlines just a few months ago during the Louisiana gubernatorial election, is now in the news mostly for being shunned by the Republican Party. The Republican Party in Georgia kept Duke off their ballot, calling him a fringe candidate whose political views are contrary to those of the party. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court denied Duke's appeal to appear on that ballot. My guest Hadding Carter points out that each time Duke seems to be politically dead, he soon undergoes a resurrection. Carter investigates the career of David Duke in a documentary that will be shown tomorrow night on public TV as part of the Frontline series. Hadding Carter grew up in Mississippi, where he began his career reporting for the newspaper run by his father. The newspaper was known for its editorial support of the civil rights movement. Carter eventually ran the paper and later became State Department spokesperson under Jimmy Carter. He's since become known for his TV commentaries on politics and the media. I asked Hadding Carter what he thinks of the Republican Party's efforts in several states to keep David Duke off the ballot.
It is in a fine old dishonorable American tradition, which is to try to force all insurgencies off the ballot and to retain the ballot only for the Orthodox. I wish I could say that this was peculiar to the Republicans. It's not. Frankly, it's a mistake. The parties ought not to be playing the exclusion game. They ought to be out there taking on this kind of insurgency head on and making of it what they can.
So what ballots does he have left? Where will he actually be on the ballot now?
You know, at this point, I'm not even sure. I think he has something like 5 of the southern states coming up that he will be on. He will be in enough places to accomplish what is one of his main objectives, if he can do it at all. That is, to get even one delegate so that he can appear at that convention as the choice of someone who will try to nominate him. He wants the vehicle of an appearance at the national convention. That, of course, scares the absolute devil out of Republican strategists.
I think a question that your frontline investigation tries to get to the bottom of is, has David Duke changed as his rhetoric has changed, or is the rhetoric just a cover for the same Ku Klux Klan and Nazi ideals that he once openly espoused?
I think that's the basic point of this documentary, is to try to answer the question not how is David Duke going to do politically, but who is this David Duke who wants to do things politically? Has he changed? He has been changing his external forms consistently ever since he was a young man. He takes off a robe and puts on a swastika, takes off the swastika and the robe and puts on an organizational label called, not as cute as he thinks it is, but cute enough, the National Association for the Advancement of White People. He then, in that guise, puts forward what is patently inoffensive notion that we have a right to organize just the same as anyone else. And behind that guise, of course, distributes virulently racist and anti-Semitic material. He then says, well, actually, that's not really me anymore, though it's still in my house. Well, who I am is who you see. The public figure who ran and got elected by my people in my legislative district in Louisiana. I'm now speaking for middle-class and working-class Americans. That's me. Then now, he says, and now, of course, I'm a man running for president, speaking for the forgotten American. But the fact is that David has a bad habit of talking privately, trusting privately, making himself open privately to folk who retain not merely their notes, but their tapes. And in those tapes emerges the private David Duke. And we are obviously playing some of those tapes on this show.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Hadding Carter, and he has a new investigation called Who is David Duke? That's going to be broadcast tomorrow evening as part of the Public Television Frontline series. David Duke has really used television to get ahead, and he's really, in a lot of ways, mastered the art of being a talk show guest and someone with good sound bites and an image that always changes to suit the times. Do you think that television is the best medium for you as a reporter to use to try to reveal who Duke really is?
I think that television is an absolutely necessary medium, but not the only one to reveal it, because it is necessary to take the person who has become a master of this medium and then to turn it around and to contrast that which he does off stage, off camera, with that public image. One of the problems is, of course, we are rapidly building a 5 billion-person media-savvy world in which everybody knows how to play the game on camera, knows how to smile and smile and smile and play still be the villain, as it were. And if you don't catch them up with the same medium, the result is the mastery of what is, in the end, a morally neutral form of communication. I've watched him a lot of times on live shows. I've watched the results, and they are often devastating because the medium is disinclined repeatedly to go as in the face with a liar is to lie. There's a level beyond which it is bad television and considered apparently bad form by interviewers to keep coming back to the person and saying, but excuse me, that is a lie. It is necessary, it seems to me, to take this form and demonstrate the lie.
Now, David Duke didn't give you an interview for your Frontline program, but his sister did. What's their relationship like?
Well, apparently it's a lot better than it used to be. She has been appalled over time by his public behavior and his private beliefs. She feels, and I really sympathize and respect the feeling, that her brother has become a changed person. She definitely wants to believe that. She expresses the belief that he has found a Christian faith that makes him no longer the hater that he was. She does not have a lot of contact with him. She is both physically separated and long ago emotionally separated from the family, but she definitely thinks that he is a changed person.
What are your personal reasons for wanting to investigate David Duke and reveal who he really is?
David Duke taps into something which is not a Southern phenomenon, but a national one. There is a large group of people in this country, white people in this country, working white people in this country, who have not only a sense of grievance against the society, but in fact are victims in this society. They are looking for reasons for their economic and social position and the problems that they face. David Duke offers them the easy answers. David Duke capitalizes on the fact that these folks are essentially outside the process and are ignored by almost everybody in it. David Duke takes people, therefore, who are already victims and twice victimizes it. If you want to get right down to it, I want, to the extent that I can, and this is pretentious as hell, but it's a fact, to the extent that I can, to say to these folks, look, find another messenger. This guy is going to betray you because in the end, he's not talking about your interest. He's talking about his own, and it's a different and a hidden agenda. I talked to some folks just sitting around in a bar. It's your typical sort of set-up bar thing. Well, at the end of it, I came away thinking, this is absolutely unfair. These guys are already really screwed over by this society, And they're sitting here believing that this is their salvation, and this salvation is going to do it to them again. It is the oldest pattern in the South. It's also one of the oldest in the nation. The abuse of the abused by the demagogue. And I hope to this extent that this documentary could at least make some small contribution in separating them away from him.
Have you had any personal encounters with Duke over the years?
You know what? I think I've been in the same room or place with him maybe three times in this entire period of time. While he was a boy over at LSU, I was running a newspaper in Mississippi. When he was developing himself as a very public Ku Klux Klansman, I was just beginning to take off to go off and work for Jimmy Carter in another type of Southerner, quite different from David Duke. So I only watched him out of the corner of my eye. I sort of hoped that what he was doing was representing the dead end of some of the worst of the Southern traditions. One of the reasons, again, that I'm interested in this piece is that I don't want to see that dead end suddenly open up onto the main highway again.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Hadding Carter, and he's the reporter on a new documentary called Who is David Duke? That will air tomorrow evening on public television as part of the Frontline series. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Hadding Carter is my guest. You grew up in Mississippi. You were born in New Orleans. Your father, when you were growing up, ran a newspaper in Mississippi. What did the Klan mean to you when you were growing up?
The Klan always meant the enemy. The Klan, it was a very interesting thing. My great-great-uncle rode with Nathan Bedford Forrest, and after the war, a Confederate general, rode with him again, at least in family legend, when he created the Klan. I say that to tell you that there was some falling away from that family tradition by the time it got to my dad, who saw the Klan as being the personification of almost all that had been destructive and sick in his native South. In our section of Mississippi, the Klan had been beaten back in the 1920s, in large part because of the effort of a very famous family, the Percy family, later one of the Percy brothers of the next generation, Walker Percy, the novelist, who received a great deal of national attention. But the Percys had confronted and beaten back the Klan in my area of Mississippi by the time I came along. Then, in the civil rights days of the 1960s, the Klan reemerges, that is, the sublimated disease comes out again in response to the pressure, and reemerges in the most vicious form since Reconstruction. Killers, arsonists, terrorists. And at that point, the Klan represented to me, I was then running the paper by then in the 1960s, the Klan represented to me a direct physical threat to me since I was on their hit list, and a direct threat to what seemed to me to be the most glorious opportunity we in the South had had since Reconstruction to remake ourselves as a more decent society.
Were there crosses ever burned on your lawn?
Sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, I still got a piece of one that was burned on my lawn, and my wife still has intact somewhere one that was burned on hers. We weren't married then. She was in Jackson, Mississippi. Quite visibly engaged in civil rights activity. But I want to say something really carefully here. I'm white. I was a person running not a large institution by absolute terms, but within that community, a newspaper. I was the last logical victim in reality for the Klan, which is, after all, run by cowards. people did get hurt, people did get killed, but they weren't white newspaper editors in Mississippi. They were mostly black folks and some stray civil rights folks who weren't black and the like. The group that educated David Duke in the wonders of white supremacy, the Citizens Councils, had a boycott against our newspaper from 1955 until 1969, and a fairly successful one in the outlying areas around the town that I lived in. And I never had much fondness for them either.
Let me ask you, when the Klan is burning a cross on your lawn and you're in the house as it's happening, what do you do?
I'll tell you a story. At the time of the integration of Ole Miss in 1962, which ultimately required federal troops to enforce, and the death of two people, I had written an editorial the morning that it occurred, saying that the governor of the state had committed sedition and should be in the federal penitentiary. We promptly lost 10% of our circulation. And that night, became pretty clear from the threats coming into the paper that bad things were going to happen. And so an off-duty deputy sheriff who was a friend and a restaurant owner who was a friend and I lay outside the house, which was out in the country, with guns all night waiting for these people to come. My wife fixing coffee and not quite reloading the guns, but you know that idea. And nobody came. Nobody came. And my dad and my brother and my uncle and my mother came driving up from New Orleans, where they were all living, to save and defend their son and brother and nephew, the case might be. And they all arrived about 5 in the morning, and of course nothing had happened. And went in, wrote the editorial about how we have to bind up the wounds and all of that, with the smoke still rising over the university campus. And we were exhausted. And we fell into bed and were all asleep by 9 o'clock, and then they came and burned the goddamn cross while we were fast asleep. And the thing that is wonderful about that, of course, is that we would have killed them. And what's even more wonderful about the fact that we didn't is that 3 days later, the sheriff, who was the only political sheriff who was ever a friend of ours, found out who they were, and they were 3 teenage kids. And we would have blown them away. We were terrified, of course. And we're lying out there with shotguns and pistols and all of that. I carried a gun for the first 6 years I was back in Mississippi, both macho business and ex-Marine and terror all combined, and put it away somewhere in the middle 60s, thank God, and never, picked it up again. But it was a time that encouraged that sort of reaction.
What makes you so sure you would have killed them had you been awake?
Because we were sitting there on hair trigger. We were there scared, and we were lying right there at the entrance to the house where they burned the cross. Well, I say killed them. I mean, hell, we would have shot. That's the nature of that sort of thing. It's what's particularly dangerous about the gun.
Yeah.
Is that it is there to be used, and when the moment comes that it may be used, you're in the clutch of an emotion which encourages you to use it quickly and think about it second.
Did you ever use it, the gun?
Never. Never. I used to carry one in my belt and in my car for a long time, and luckily nothing ever occurred that required me to use it. And what did happen, and the real reason I put the gun away, was that one of my brothers killed himself with a pistol, and that pretty much encouraged me to believe that no good except grief would ever come out of a gun.
Was it suicide or accident?
Well, it was an accident which occurred at a time and he was playing idiot games with a pistol. So, what do you call it?
Right.
But he was a college student at the time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Haddon Carter, and he has a documentary on David Duke that airs tomorrow night on Frontline on public television. You know, in talking about David Duke, you think that Duke has a new rhetoric, but that his beliefs haven't fundamentally changed. Have you ever met somebody who you knew or knew of when they were in the Klan who you believe really has changed?
Yes, actually, I have. It's a strange thing. There was a guy who was a killer. He went to the pen He was involved in a very famous incident in Meridian, Mississippi, in which the FBI, in effect, entrapped him and his girlfriend as they were coming to kill a Jewish leader in Meridian, killed the girlfriend, wounded him, and pretty well put him away for a while in the pen. And somewhere in that period, he had what he believed to be a major religious experience and considered himself to be born again. And by every indication, ever since he's been out till this moment, has been out there living and preaching an approach which is totally different. Now, I cannot read into the depths of a person's soul, but I can certainly tell a difference in the way people behave on a consistent basis, and he has. But he's not unique. I mean, I initially carried long memories about people's position, whether they had been Klansmen in the 20s and I'd heard the family stories, or whether they had been major Citizens Council figures during the days of the organization of that segregationist group. And for a long time, I wasn't willing to accept the fact that people could change. And then it became very obvious to me that they had and they were. That they simply had reappraised what it was that they had been thinking, and in the light of what they now saw, had fallen away. Also, let me say something about most people. Most of us find it easier to go with the tide than to swim against it. But when the tide changes, a lot of people feel mighty liberated about not having to be going in that particular direction. And folk can, in fact, free themselves from old mindsets.
That's an interesting point. Can I ask you if there's any one thing that you're finding particularly interesting about this presidential campaign? Any one thing that's particularly surprising you?
No, what surprised me and disheartened me and indicated the near fatal condition of the Democratic Party is a list which begins with the word Rockefeller, moves through Bradley, Cuomo, Gore, Nunn, and moves on from there, of all those who were, in fact, people who were seen as being first-tier figures who didn't run out of pure gutlessness or out of some sense that their better day would come another day, and that what we now have are, in fact, some fairly able guys, but not what you'd call household names, out there fighting for the nomination. I was surprised by the failure of so many of these other folks to get in. The other thing I'm interested in is that, in its own halting way, the Democratic primary is finally going about the business of, in effect, declaring victory and trying to get on with redefining the Democratic Party. By declaring victory, meaning actually the New Deal, Fair Deal, Great Society programs, even under Reagan, are now sort of permanent warp and woof. So let's quit talking about that stuff and let's talk about some of the problems that confront us in the future, not least of them being how do we make this economic engine work again. I'm surprised that that has come out as fast as it has, and that's irretrievable, I would add. That's going to be part of the debate from now on.
Do you ever want to run for office?
Did I ever want to run for office is the question to which I would answer yes. Do I want to now? The answer is no. Dreams of glory probably still awaken me in the middle of the night, but they don't consume my daytime. They don't consume my daytime thinking.
Hodding Carter, his documentary about David Duke, airs tomorrow night on the PBS series Frontline. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dame Edna Everidge describes herself as a housewife, megastar, investigative journalist, chanteuse, swami, and polymath. Dame Edna is the creation of Australian performer Barry Humphries. He's turned his creation into a comic critique of celebrityhood. Coming up, we talk with Dame Edna about, you know, the usual stuff, her triumphs and tragedies as a much-envied superstar. And Soviet emigre David Gurevich goes back to Russia to visit the KGB. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has vetoed a bill that would place conditions on granting most favored nation trade status to China. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
In his veto message, Mr. Bush says that he shares the goals and objectives of H.R. 2212. He says human rights, arms control, and free and fair trade are issues of vital concern. But he says that presenting China's leaders with an ultimatum on most favored nation trade status will only weaken ties with the West. According to the president's statement, H.R. 2212 would severely handicap U.S. business in China, penalizing American workers, and eliminating jobs in this country. The end result in China, he says, would be to encourage the Chinese leadership to turn inward against the world. Conditioning China's most favored nation trade status would damage modernizing elements in China, weaken Hong Kong, and strengthen opposition to democracy and economic reform. The United States is making a difference in China, Mr. Bush says, by remaining engaged. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
And the White House says that President Bush will meet next week with Jordan's King Hussein. During the Persian Gulf War, Jordan's pro-Iraqi stance angered many U.S. officials, and this will be the first meeting for the two leaders since the Jordanian leader met Mr. Bush in Maine shortly after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. A spokesman says the president will certainly discuss the situation in Iraq today and a need for continued U.N. sanctions. The Bush administration is proposing an intelligence budget without major reductions. Unlike reduced funding proposals for defense, which reflect the demise of Soviet communism, the secret intelligence budget is estimated to be near Cold War levels. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The administration suggests spending $30 billion next year for intelligence operations, about the same level as last year's budget, angering some Democrats on Capitol Hill. Opponents argue that the intelligence budget ought to be pared down by the same amount as the defense budget, of which it is part. Intelligence spending doubled during the 1980s. Now some Democrats argue it should be reduced to reflect developments in the Soviet Union. While funding for reconnaissance operations is at the same level as last year, some members of both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees say that spending on spy satellites should be reduced now that there is not a pressing need to track Soviet missile and troop movements. But when CIA Director Robert Gates was scrutinized by the Senate Intelligence Committee last year, he was reluctant to agree to any new reductions in intelligence spending. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 7 points to close at 3,275.27 on volume of some 180 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 9-8. This is NPR News. President Bush is now back in Washington after a weekend of campaigning in Georgia, one of several states holding primaries and caucuses tomorrow. One of those states is Maryland, where Democratic presidential candidates met in debate last night and focused their attacks more on Mr. Bush than each other. Senator Bob Kerry skipped the Maryland debate and today sharpened his campaign theme, claiming that he is more electable than the two apparent frontrunners, Paul Tsongas and Bill Clinton. NPR's Scott Simon reports from Seattle.
Just a day before pivotal primaries in Georgia and Maryland, where his principal opponents are expected to score well, Senator Kerry soared between stops in San Francisco, Seattle, Idaho, and Colorado, presenting himself as a candidate of the West, which he says the Democrats must win to defeat President Bush in the fall. He told a news conference in San Francisco today he did not regret some of the personal, pointed criticisms he's recently made of his opponents.
We're out there running for the most powerful dollars in the world. I mean, if you can take a few bumps in a presidential campaign, I'm not sure you've got the capacity to be Commander-in-Chief of the United States Armed Forces.
Polls show Senator Kerry running well behind Paul Tsongas and Bill Clinton in Colorado, which will hold a presidential primary tomorrow. But on this thrust west, the senator is also stirring up financial support so that a campaign that's begun to center around electability can survive another round of elections. This is Scott Simon with the Kerry campaign in Seattle.
In New York City, diplomats say a high-level Iraqi delegation will arrive in the U.N. next week and speak before the U.N. Security Council about doing away with the nation's weapons of mass destruction. Last Friday, the U.N. Security Council said that Baghdad had less than 2 weeks to explain its position and comply with ceasefire agreements, that all weapons of mass destruction be destroyed. U.N. officials said Iraq would face serious consequences if it didn't. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. She's been pursued by Warren Beatty. She's friends with the Queen of England. She's a much-adored housewife-turned-megastar. She remembers her roots, and she's never bothered with elitist things like bodyguards and private jets. She's Dame Edna Everage, and she's actually the creation of Australian performer Barry Humphries. He created the character in 1955. Dame Edna's one-woman shows are sellouts in London, and she's recently been catching on in America. Humphries uses Dame Edna to comically critique self-absorbed celebrities and the excesses of our culture. We invited Humphries to talk with us about Dame Edna, but he showed up as Dame Edna herself. Like so many celebrities before her, Dame Edna has written her autobiography. It's called My Gorgeous Life, The Life, The Loves, The Legend. Here's a reading.
You know, it's funny to think there'll be millions of people reading this bestseller of mine. Some voluntarily, many as a compulsory school or university textbook, who have never heard of me. What a vain woman I'd be if I thought everyone on the planet adored me. Chances are you might run away with the idea this is another showbiz autobiography written by a ghost for some stupid empty-headed glamour puss. No way! This book is going to give new hope to zillions of men and women across the ethno-socio-economic board, because it's the true story of one woman's journey from the kitchen sink to the corridors of power. A woman who has nonetheless remained natural, approachable, and, let's face it, humble.
Okay.
Oh, I could go on reading forever, Terry. I had to break off then, just as it was getting exciting.
You've travelled such a far distance in your life. What was your life like back when you were a suburban mother? What fulfilled you then?
Well, I have to say this, Terry, and I feel I'm getting to know you quite well, even though we're just talking on the wireless. I am still a suburban mother. Although I'm a megastar, fundamentally and spiritually, I'm wrist deep in washing up water. But my life was very, very ordinary. I had three young children running around my ankles. I seemed to spend my life at the kitchen sink, staring out through the chipped Venetian blinds to our little backyard where my children played.
Dame Edna, now you're a megastar, but being a megastar isn't just about having the admiration of your fans. You've needed courage and strength to survive the emotional traumas that life has put you through.
Yes.
I mean, for instance, your late husband had terrible prostate trouble. How did that affect your intimate life?
Well, fortunately for the worse, because I've never really placed that aspect of human relationships very high on the list of priorities for me, Terry. And between you and me, I don't think many women do. I really think that, you know, our little private parts have been blown out of all proportion. In publicity, in women's magazines, the sort of thing you read under the dryer in a hairdresser is always, isn't it, about the sexual side of people's lives. In fact, so many other things are more important. And I was lucky that that aspect of my life with my husband was nipped in the bud, literally, I might say, by Norm's prostatological complications. But fortunately, his prostate transplant, it was the first that ever happened in the world, gave new hope to prostate sufferers all over the world. So my husband its memory belongs to science. And that's filled me with a great deal of joy. However, I did have three children. And I felt that was enough, quite frankly. And Norm, that was my husband's name, Norman, short for Norman, as in Schwarzkopf. Norm, I don't think, was too much interested in that side of things as well. Luckily, I think we were very similar in many ways. We didn't have single beds, Terry, but we slept quite a fair way apart on the edges of our double bed. And, as much as I'm prepared to say over the wireless.
Are you still running the Dame Edna Prostate Foundation?
Yes, I am, in fact, chairman of the world organization called Friends of the Prostate. I founded it. And it really is to help people understand the prostate. It's educational, of course. We built a theme park where there is, in fact, a walk-through prostate, a beautiful thing in fiberglass, and it has restaurants, bowling alleys, synagogue, and disabled toilets. And also, of course, we sell things, you know, in order to raise money for further prostate research, like oven mitts and fudge.
Dame Edna, I have another personal question for you. Was it hard for you to begin having relationships with men again after your husband passed away?
Well, it was. But I have had relationships with men, but platonic ones. I haven't played hospitals with anyone yet, to use an expression, which we used to use when we were young schoolgirls, or playing cars and garages with members of the opposite sex, or ships and harbours, for that matter. A game which my brothers occasionally suggested, but which you'll be very relieved to hear I rejected contemptuously. However, I have had approaches. I'm an attractive woman. In fact, if anything, I'm more attractive than I've been before in my life. And my gynaecologist, Terry, looked up the other day. Incidentally, my gynaecologist is Julio Iglesias's father. Did you know he was a gynaecologist?
I didn't.
I learnt that because I had Julio as a guest on one of my TV shows in Britain, and he told me that his father was a gynaecologist, and I asked him if he ever brought his work home with him. But my gynaecologist looked up, and he said to me the other day, he said, "Dame Edna, you are at the height of your powers as a woman." And he said, "Theoretically, you're still capable of having grandchildren," which was very, very nice to hear. As you can imagine, Terry. But I've had advances from very handsome men like Klaus von Bülow, Prince Rainier of Monaco. You know, single and very desirable gentlemen. But no, not at the moment. We go out to dinner, you know, we boogie into the night. But when it comes to dropping me off at my luxury home in Beverly Hills, I'm afraid it's a quick little peck on the cheek and in the door.
My guest is Dame Edna Everidge. She's written a new autobiography called My Gorgeous Life. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Housewife turned megastar Dame Edna Everidge is my guest.
I hate to try to get women to be competitive with each other, but I must ask you who you think is more glamorous, you or Margaret Thatcher?
Margaret Thatcher was a little more glamorous, mainly because she begged me to give her advice. She was, quite frankly, a formidable and rather unattractive bully of a woman who'd wore pretty dreary clothes. But there was a fashion in England about 10 years ago for famous women to ring me up when it was leaked into the press that the Queen of England was getting my advice on her clothes. Then, of course, when I was the godmother to Princess Diana and Prince Charles's first baby, I became a little bit of a sort of fashion guru and quite the flavour of the year. And I was
very, very surprised when I heard from Margaret Thatcher, whose ratings were falling a bit, that my advice was being sought. And, you know, I got her to do her hair differently. I got her to put a little bit of a violet rinse in it, so it looked a little bit like mine. My son, Kenny, who's a wonderful couturier, designed some clothes for her. And there was a transformation. Unfortunately, it came too late, and now the woman is out of office and having a rather quiet nervous breakdown somewhere.
Would you describe yourself as a feminist?
Well, I think I'm one of the founders of world feminism, Terry, because Germaine Greer was, her parents were neighbours of ours, and every time she called in after school to see me, I'd make her a little few cookies or something of the kind, she'd have to step over my husband, who was very often scrubbing the kitchen floor. And I think it could put ideas in Germaine's mind, because later she was to write a famous feminist text. And she has thanked me personally. And my copy of The Female Eunuch has an inscription in it to Dame Edna, my old friend who gave me the idea for this book, Germaine. Well, that puts me pretty much in the vanguard, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You know, your manager is Barry Humphrey, so I believe is with you now. And I, as I understand it, the way you first met him is he was doing a drag theater show, and he wanted to seek your advice.
It was pathetic.
What do you think of men who dress as women and pretend they're women on stage?
I think there is something quite seriously wrong with them. I haven't discussed this with doctors, but I think the medical profession, and a lot of doctors will be tuned into this by now. In fact, people from every walk of life will be tuned into this broadcast. I think doctors would have something to say about it. I think it means that a man is a bit dissatisfied with his own, what Dame Nature has given him, don't you, Terry? That he wishes to be something else. And, you know, of course, actors do dress up as all kinds of things, not just women. They dress up as old people, don't they? King Lear, that Shakespeare part. That's sort of old person, isn't it? And I suppose when you think about it, acting is pretending to be someone else. But I've generally speaking found that members of the acting profession are a bit odd.
Is your manager Barry Humphreys there?
He is. He, fortunately, I'm talking to you very quietly, darling. He didn't hear what I just said, so please don't embarrass him.
Okay.
Embarrass me by telling him. Barry, darling. Barry. Oh, little Terry wants a word with you.
Terry?
Hi, Barry Humphreys. Hello. Thank you for joining us.
What's Dame Edna been saying?
I hope
she's been being polite.
Well, you can listen to the broadcast or, you know, hear a rebroadcast
of it.
But
good,
yeah.
Good.
Did Dame Edna give you good advice when you were doing your drag act?
I think so. She actually dissuaded me. I was a young comedian in Australia, and I'd invented this character who was a sort of housewife, rather like Dame Edna, as a matter of fact, was in the old days. And she'd had a bit of publicity. She'd won this lovely mother competition. And I asked her if she'd come along and give me some advice. She came to the theatre where I was rehearsing, just one of those little small theatres seating about 200 people. And she sat there and watched me do this performance. And afterwards she said that it hadn't made her laugh, and she thought that it was in very bad taste, and she thought that the dress that I was wearing was an insult to women. And she was very forthright and, in fact, rather unkind, I thought, at the time. She dashed my confidence so much that I was never able to do this performance again. But I did ask if she knew so much about it, whether she wouldn't mind playing the part in the show that opened the following evening. Well, that was a historic suggestion that I made to Dame Edna, because, or Mrs. Everidge, as she was called then, because she went on stage and she stole the show. All she did was just talk about her life. She didn't have gags. It wasn't very funny. She didn't tell funny stories. She just talked about herself. And indeed, that's all she ever does to this day.
Well, we're out of time. I thank you very much for joining us while you're in the United States.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you.
Can I thank Dame Edna? She's still
sure.
Down. Dame Edna, thank you very much for the interview.
Oh, Terry, thank you so much. Goodbye.
Dame Edna's new memoir, My Gorgeous Life, is published by Simon & Schuster. Dame Edna is the creation of Australian performer Barry Humphries. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Well, Robert, tomorrow might not be Super Tuesday, but there's about 8 primaries coming up tomorrow. Will you have previews for us?
4 caucuses. They're calling it Junior Tuesday, and we will. We'll have a report by Phyllis Crockett looking ahead to tomorrow's primary in Maryland, which is being contested very hard by the Democratic candidates. And we'll be hearing from Linda Wertheimer, who is in Georgia, talking with voters there. In Georgia, there are very big primaries, both on the Republican side and the Democratic side. Another Buchanan challenge to Bush, and it's a race that Governor Clinton is seen as having to win if he's to be regarded as electable. Also, Andy Bowers reports on the record of Patrick Buchanan.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you live long enough, you find that life is full of irony. Soviet emigre David Gurevich found that out recently when he returned to Russia to drop in on the KGB.
Moscow is a lousy place in winter. Wet, chilly, muddy. Power is running low. This is the darkest city of 8 million that I have ever seen. Russians are still stunned by the tenfold increase in prices. They literally don't know what hit them. We know what hit them. Capitalism. Capitalist greed has now swept Russia like socialism never did. I read about the prison camp administration in the Urals that charges foreign reporters $1,500 a day, officially, for visiting the camp. Gulag for sale. Is nothing sacred anymore? The KGB, or what's left of it, is trying to keep up as well. They even have guided tours of their headquarters now, at $30 a pop. Here Chairman Andropov used to sit. Here poison pen taken from CIA spy. Total ripoff. But wait, there's more. In January, I saw articles in the Washington Post and Wall Street Journal about two Hollywood companies who claimed they had bought certain KGB files which would reveal secrets like the Rosenberg's case and the Cuban crisis. Hot stuff. The article sounded as if cardboard boxes full of reports were being loaded on planes and later transformed by Hollywood hacks into, ta-da, the KGB, the series, brought to you by... I was skeptical, but could I resist a scoop? A New York magazine called Details sent me to investigate. Most people in Moscow would have trouble finding Kolpachny Lane, where the Russian Foreign Intelligence Public Relations Office is located. But I knew Kolpachny. It brought back a lot of memories. 17 years ago, I stood in line right across the street at the KGB visa section for my exit visa. I'm telling you, once upon a time, I was branded a traitor. And now I'm sitting down to interview the foreign intelligence officials. Thank you. be fair, I was not talking to the internal police thugs who had once persecuted Sakharov and Solzhenitsyn. The smooth-talking guys whom I interviewed took pains to point out the difference. They were glamour boys, Ruski James Bonds, who had put in years in the West. "We wear the same brand of shoes," I remarked to one of them. "Of course," he grinned. "Timberland." If before they used to think of themselves as James Bonds, now they see themselves as Ian Flemings. For example, the lucky owner of Timberlands, Oleg Tsarev, has already paired up with a British writer named John Costello, and they have a book coming out about a Soviet spy who used to run the so-called Cambridge Group, which included famous spies like Kim Philby. And, of course, they're not selling any files. Well, maybe. In the future. There are negotiations underway. Even so, the money will not be paid for the files proper. Just some carefully edited bits and pieces. It won't be a sale. It will be consulting services. Other KGB men got plenty of stories to tell as well. After a bottle of vodka, they'll talk your head off. We got along famously. To them, I was no longer a traitor, but a successful colleague, a published author. I ended up conducting a mini-seminar on publishing, editors, agents. Yes, nowadays KGB agents are looking for Western literary agents. Agents who need agents are the luckiest agents in the world.
David Gurevich is the author of From Lenin to Lenin. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblitis, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
From Russia with love, I fly to you. Much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world to learn I must return from Russia with love. I've seen places, faces, and smiled for a moment, but oh, you haunted me so.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In the past few months, the Clarence Thomas hearings, the Mike Tyson trial, and the anti-abortion movement have given focus to the anger and frustrations of many women. But what impact has that had on the women's movement? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with feminist and writer Deirdre English. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.